Well, hello, listener, yet again. This is another episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes, in which me, myself, I, Professor Stephen Fielding, and my co-presenter, Emma Burnell, look at different sort of examples of popular culture and how they may relate to politics. So that's a hello from me and a hello from Emma.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And today we've got a guest, Logan Murray, who is an author, a comedian, and a director, and who has great experience with running comedic workshops, which becomes relevant when I tell you that today we're going to talk about a play by the recently deceased Trevor Griffiths, Comedians, which was first put on in 1975, I think, at the Nottingham Playhouse. And luckily for us, there's a version, a rather blurry version, at least for me, a rather blurry version of the time when the BBC actually turned that play into a play for today. And I think it went out in 1978 or something like that. And the reason why we're talking about the play is, first of all, because I'm a big fan of Trevor Griffiths. Trevor Griffiths was a political playwright who came to prominence in the 1970s from the sort of perspective of the New Left. He was in the 1960s very active in the Labour Party, became disenchanted with it, like many younger people in the post-war period did at that time. And as a working class man, or certainly from working class background, first of his generation to go to university, he had a sort of unique perspective on the party, and he articulated it through writing plays. And he found fame initially writing for the National Theatre about a play called The Party, which was about sort of sectarianism in the late 1960s and how the far left responded to the Paris events and all of that. And he had, great success on the stage, and Comedians is one of those plays. But he essentially was somebody who thought, if I'm going to actually influence how people think, and that's what he really wanted to do, people like from his own background, I should go on TV. And he had some interesting work that was on TV. Bill Brand, an 11-part series that ITV put on at 9 o'clock on a Monday in 1976 about a left-wing Labour MP. I mean, can you imagine that? So I'm a great fan for all kinds of reasons, but Comedians, I think, is one of his most successful and certainly well-known plays. And if I can just set the scene for you, then go to Logan and to Emma. Comedians is set like in a Manchester, and he's from Manchester. That's the one reason why I think I also like him. In a Manchester further education college, it's a class for comedians, and it's run by an old successful, but his career has sort of gone off the rails at some point. A successful comedian, Eddie Waters, and there's a group of about five or six aspirational comedians, some of whom from working class backgrounds. There's a club owner, but they're mostly very men who want men, and they're all men who want to make it as comedians for all kinds of different reasons. And the play has them gather together on a very wet and rainy Manchester night. It never rains in Manchester, obviously. That's a stereotype. And they're about to do their act in front of an agent, hoping that they're going to get picked up, and then that will be the start of a brilliant career as a stand-up comedian. And I think that's probably enough, but enough of a setup. I mean, other than the night in the 1970s, it was the high peak of the stand-up club comedian. And there was a kind of a transition at this period of time, thanks to a series called The Comedians, that was on ITV, which brought some of these club comics to the small screen. And if I say that one of the most successful transitional characters of that series and then made it very big was Bernard Manning, which I don't know if our listener needs any explanation about Bernard Manning, but he was a little bit racist, a little bit sexist, but very successful. The play kind of comes out maybe on the back of that and maybe reflecting on some of that. So it's about comedy, but it's also about politics. But I think I've certainly said enough about that. Now, Logan, you actually run, these workshops with comedians. I mean, how did that sort of, as a reflection of what you do, how did it come across?
Well, it's very much of its time. First, the demographics are completely different. So I've been teaching people, I don't know, about since about 2000, bit before late 90s, if include. Anyway, and the demographics different. There's usually at least a third women to two-thirds men, and most of the courses are half of women and half men. So that's completely different. So in that case, it's a real sort of time capsule, you know. You were saying about the comedians, the resonance for me was that there's a very punk aesthetic in the whole thing. I don't want to spoil it for people who haven't seen it yet, and it is worth watching. The play for
Logan,
today.
we don't worry about spoilers here because we assume that people can be grown up about them. So
Okay,
please spoil away.
well, yeah, so there's a very punk aesthetic within in one of the main protagonists, in my opinion. And even though it was done in 75, you've got to think about 76 or 77, we did have punk. We also had, and I think alternative cabaret, which then became modern comedy, the main influences for it. One of the main things was punk, another one was feminism, another one was agitprop theatre. I mean, agitprop theatre, where's that? You know, a little bit of Cambridge and Oxford reviews, you know, sort of absurdism or you know, Monty Python-esque type things. But the main thing, I may be going away from the text of the play, but the main thing why we like comedians as a play at the time was because it was pointing the finger towards something else. We didn't, it's called alternative. Originally, alternative cabaret, that's a term Tony Allen came up with, but alternative comedy, as it became a few months later, we didn't know where we were going, but we knew we were fighting against Bernard Manning. We knew we were fighting against lazy stereotypes and kicking down. I mean, a lot of these terms hadn't been articulated, but there's a big thing in comedy, and it comes out in the play as well, that all humour has to have a target. You know, there has to be, I phrase it differently, there has to be a direction. In it, you know, so in the first half of the play, the teacher's trying to get them to mind their own lives for experience. So they're the idiot in the routine. And then when they realize they're losing a drunken crowd at Working Men's Club, a couple of them, you know, completely throw in the towel and just start kicking down at different, you know, like here's an Irish joke, here's a Pakistani joke, here's this. And just because they know they can get that, ha ha, you know, that sort of,
And be successful
terrific.
comedian. Yeah, get
Yeah.
paid for the
No,
age.
but yeah, but then you think about it for the time, for all the successful, yeah, that was, it's ever thus. There's always been a, I mean, the world, but I think again, I went to Tony Allen's funeral in January, and I'm misquoting him, but he said something brilliant like, the entertainer gives the audience what they think they want, and the artist gives them what they didn't know they needed.
Right.
And I think we, it's very easy to go, oh, yeah, women can't drive. Irish people are stupid. You know, you're not changing anything at all. But the modern generation of comedians, I think, I say modern from 2000s onwards, or 1990s onwards, it's been about some element has been about trying to change. It sounds very, I mean, it's basically at the end of the day, it's making people laugh, but it's how you decide to do that. And if it's you think about a joke, all a joke, like any new idea, changes your mind. Yeah, you create a new neural pathway in your brain every time you have a new idea, and you go, yeah. And if it's a joke, you go, huh? You know, and when you write that joke for the first time, you go, yeah. And then the second time you do go, oh, it's a bit obvious, isn't it? Because you've already made that connection, you know? But that's what the modern generation of comedians try to do at their best, even though we do fall into the idea of pandering to a crowd or, you know, trying to back up. I mean, it's not just telling racist or sexist jokes. You think, how many times have you seen a comedian on Question Time? And they'll say something like, well, I think we should support the NHS. And everyone goes, I think we should support, you know, a living wage. Not really changing the world, is it? It's not, I mean, of course they shouldn't be saying let's bring back slavery, but it's not changing anything, you know. It's just backing up you know, what everyone's thinking.
Because in the play there is a basic debate, isn't there, between the teacher Eddie, who wants comedy to be more than simply going for laughs. In fact, that's the last thing really you should be going for, in some respects. And then the agent, who is basically saying it's only about laughs, and you know you're not here to teach them anything. And he's the one that wants them to pander to stereotypes. He actively says that. So there is this sort of very sort of basic debate within the play.
No, I was just interested, if you're seeing in your workshops with people coming up now, whether you're seeing a backlash to that sort of the new comfort zone, as it were, and people trying to be more provocative in the other direction.
Not really. No, not. I mean, there's always been a bunch of, I mean, luckily I don't get many of them. In fact, I don't think I get any of them on the course I run. But within the business, there's always this, and I'm sure you came across them, Emma, as well, when you, just to out you, because you've done a few gigs, but that we call them edge lords. Generally speaking, we're talking about young men fresh from college. They're usually white, they're usually at least middle class. They're usually between, they've got, that's awful, I sound like my dad, they've got no bloody experience, but they've got very little to talk about. So they'll think, well, what can I do to shock you? And I've actually heard an American comedian who is the archetype of that go, have I shocked you yet? Have I shocked you? And it's like, a joke should shock anyway because it's a new idea. It's not because what is revolutionary about a 25-year-old talking about masturbation? Oh my God, you know, or you know, doing something which is clearly a thought experiment, something incredibly, I mean, I don't want to swear on the show, but you know, like there's, I can think of one comedian in particular who will just, you know, say something incredibly transgressive just for the oh, yeah. So you've got that tiny extreme, but the more, in my opinion, the slightly more worrying trend, and it comes up every time on the course, is are we allowed to say that anymore? And I think that I was looking back at the stuff that I wrote back in the 80s, and like, so I was having a lot of discussions with comedians then. And we're still having the same discussions then. Is that okay to do? What's the focus of the material? Are we, you know, this idea of like every joke has to have a target. Well, a lazy comic might then assume every joke has to have a victim. Yeah. Like we feel better about ourselves because we point the finger at the outsider and kind of go, aren't they stupid? Yeah. For this reason. And it just reinforces a view. So people go, oh, am I allowed to do that? I can't, you know. But the vast majority of men who say, I hope I'm making sense, too much coffee. But the vast majority of blokes who, and it is blokes who will ask that question on the course, tend to be middle-aged blokes who are incredibly privileged. So you've got these young people who will do that. And then you get some middle-aged blokes who say, oh, you're not allowed to say anything yet, are you? Not allowed to use the N-word. And I'm thinking, well, why would you want to? What possible reason would you, as somebody who lives in Surrey, you know, what you change, you know, that sort of thing. But the more worrying thing, I think, is, and again, I'm stepping on eggshells here, is the worrying about who thought the left would become so policing. When you think about the decades we've had about the left encouraging free speech and discourse, and you know, you've got a perfect right to say it, to paraphrase somebody, but I've got the perfect right to punch you in the mouth if I disagree, or to disagree verbally. You know, who decided this couldn't be said? But I know I'm an incredibly I speak as a somebody who subscribes to The Guardian, so I feel I'm incredibly thin ice saying that. But yeah, so there are some. I think the technical term for this is arseholes, but the vast majority of people are just trying to uncover their inner idiot, and if I think something, or if a comedian thinks something, then the probability is loads of other people think it too. And there is a Swiftian, it doesn't sound too poncy, a Swiftian idea of like pointing the finger and going, "What's that? That's rubbish, isn't it? That's rubbish. Why do we do that?" You know.
I mean,
I mean,
the
I
plot.
think a lot of it, you're right. It's the Emperor's New Clothes. A lot of comedy, the Emperor's New Clothes, isn't it? It's saying, you know that thing that everyone is saying is true? It's bollocks.
No, I was just going to say, because the play, it's however, it's is on. I mean, it's quite the reverse situation, isn't it? I mean, it's like they're almost feel compelled to do the, you know, they do the Pakistani, you know, in a on charged with rape, and the lazy Irish, all of that. That it's the opposite. That seems to be, you should be saying this. I mean, that's the battle that Eddie, the teacher, is having, saying, no, you don't. You know, that is lazy. You shouldn't be saying all of that. Whereas the
Isn't
other,
that,
but the
yeah.
commercial imperative is to say all of that. So
But that's the easy path. If you look at any art form, right? You go to the National Gallery, or you go at any art form, any play, you look at the plays from the 1950s, not many of them get done anymore. You know, there's things which are trapped in their time because everyone's doing what everyone else is doing. I mean, again, imagine, I mean, all the artists were with Picasso, right? You can't imagine anybody saying, you know, you can't imagine Picasso going, "Oh, don't know, blue lips. Don't think they're going to buy into that, are they?" You know, it's like there's a handful of people who go, "I'm going to practice the craft and see what this releases." And that's a much more, it's better for the audience, you know. But the easy rewards, again, I started in 84. Alternative comedy only being a couple of years in those days. But I remember people, you know, sort of fishing around at genres, going, "Would you like to do this? Would you like to do that? Would you like to do this game show? Would you like to?" And the game shows then, or the daytime TV thing, there were no roots into TV and radio. But my God, what an alluring prospect it is if you just finished signing on for the Dole. You were still using a fake name, like many of us were doing, so that the Social Security couldn't catch up with us. I mean, that's when you think about all those punk poets with the stupid names. That's why. You know, and then somebody says, "Would you do this?" And it's the glamour, the allure of doing this thing. And if you get sucked into that, you know, you lose your artistic soul, you know. I mean, how many people can you think of who have done good work and then have gone down a commercial route, have kind of sucked?
But in the play, I mean, if you're talking about those who took the artistic route, of the five or six white, mostly working class men who were in this class, there's only one, Geffen, who takes what might be considered to be the artistic route. I mean, he's the he's I mean, they all refer to him as being, you know, Eddie the teacher's pet, and then but he suddenly decides he's going to totally change his act. And he's the one that, when he goes on in this Manchester club, he does his, you know, what might be seen as sort of agitprop, I don't know, alternative cabaret. You know, he's got a white face. I mean, when, you know, I th obviously the audience was completely nonplussed by what he did. And to be frank, I thought it was completely, you know, I didn't understand what he was trying to do. And he, but he's the only one that does it, and then is seen to be commercially, obviously, a great failure. But all the other men, they just want to make it. They're mostly from working class backgrounds. They also make some money. They want to escape their shitty little jobs. Excuse me, listener, I shouldn't have said that. And just to make some money, you know, doing comedy. So, but they were working class men. So I don't know if now could, the people that you do with workshops are all the slightly more elevated in terms of
The class wankers,
There might be now. But in another sense, the middle class has been hollowed out, hasn't it? We're reaching sort of American states now, where they're, we just distress gentility. We think that I still buy polenta, but we're worried about this, that, and the other. Back in the 80s when it started, there was no business. There was no. It was just a bunch of people who were unemployable, who knew they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to do that. They didn't want to do Irish jokes. They didn't want to, they got girlfriends who were second or some, of either gender, whose partners were second or third generation feminists, and they didn't want to do that, or they didn't, so they were trying to find a new thing to do. So there were an awful lot of working class people in it. Then fast forward 5 or 6 years, this is completely outside, but I'll just say, before I go, because I'm just turning into that old bloke at the bus stop talking about things in the 90s, but one failure possibly in the play is that, and this is just an opinion, is that when Gethin does the bit at the end, there were no laughs. There were no laughs in the piece that was done. And in real life, if you don't hit the ground running and there aren't laughs, that's all you've got to do in the business. I've seen incredibly mind-bending things on stage that have made people laugh, right? But that was just 4 or 5 minutes of I was going to say threat, but it's not really threat, but like of aggression, or just, and I guess Griffiths is trying to say that the thing about when he talks about Auschwitz and that, when he says the idea that there's, I mean, Darwin's theory of humor is that we use, you probably all know this, but we use humor to symbolically slay our enemies, because there'll be an evolutionary cost if we actually stab them. We might get stabbed back. But if we can, in a humorous term, cut them down to size, put them in their place, then they become less of a threat. So there is this idea of aggression, and especially in the 70s, when you think about, when it was still, we were all believing in B.F. Skinner, there was still this idea of, we're just big fat meat robots. So that's the only thing that could, it would have ruined the play, would have ruined the play. But to be more realistic, he would have, if he'd, he wouldn't have stayed on that long at a working men's club if there were no laughs. You'd give 20 seconds, then somebody would go, "If you're gonna sing, sing," or "Taxi," or something like that,
Well, though he did keep shouting "taxi" during the period, or
Oh
was ever quite sure
but
why.
it's a heckle. It's a heckle. If somebody's
Yes.
on stage and they're dying, people go, "Taxi for Mr. Murray,"
Yeah, although he was heckling himself on that basis, given he was shouting
Well, I
"taxi."
don't think he was. It was part of the routine. It was part of
Well,
the
I know
routine,
that's why,
wasn't it?
but I didn't really understand why he was saying "taxi." But anyway, that's
Because
a
he
minor.
was doing the voice of the, I mean, he was doing the voice of the bloke who he was aggressing, and he was like ventriloquizing the posh bloke going, "Taxi," trying to get out of here, and then Gethin's still there.
I guess you're right. It didn't really. I was generally foxed by that. Although we were meant to think, I mean, his teacher at the end says that was brilliant. So I'm going, was it?
Yeah,
But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
that was a gold standard for Trevor Griffiths in terms of he was expressing himself. I think that was the point. He was expressing the
Yeah,
hate
yeah.
that was in him.
As someone who
Yeah.
has long
Sorry, Emma.
been a fan of comedy and has tried it, not terribly successfully, but better than I would have been if I hadn't taken your course, Logan. I think the interesting thing is, yeah, ultimately, you have to be able to laugh. But the best comedy also makes you slightly uncomfortable, I find. But there are ways and ways of being uncomfortable. And I think what Jonathan Pryce's character Gethin was doing was making his audience exceptionally uncomfortable, but he never undercut that with a laugh. And where I think what the teacher was saying in the brilliance is, yes, you're absolutely ready to challenge your audience in ways that will take you far further than any of these comfort comedians. You've got to put the bloody laughs in.
I agree. Well, there's a bloke who died last year or the year before, Paul Incognito. I'll have to sanitize it for this, but he was really, there's people like him, you can, they're incredibly popular, you could say critically, they could be viewed as incredibly problematic, but they're very good comedians, technically much better than me. Incognito and Jerry Sadowitz, just because they're both two people who are very confrontational. But Ian's thing, when he'd go on stage, he'd take his coat off, he'd get a nail and a hammer, he'd hammer the nail into the wall at any venue, didn't get permission to do it, hung his coat up, and I'd have to sanitize it slightly to the podcast, but he'd go, "My name's Incognito. Now you know two things about me. One, I don't give an F, and two, I've got a hammer." And that's his start. So it's like, bang, this is the world we're in. You know what I mean? And it gets a laugh, it gets a release, but then you just carry, he carries on taking no prisoners.
What's interesting about this group of people is that I wouldn't have said that being a stand-up comic is the obvious escape route from poverty. I mean, so I think there's something more to it. They don't just want to be removed from their day jobs as milkman, factory worker. What they also want is to be elevated and have that proud adulation, maybe get to the television studio. There's more to it than simply wanting the economic benefits, because if you're going for economic benefit, I wouldn't say that stand-up comedy, even in its heyday in the 70s that they were trying to be part of, was the most obvious route out of that. But there's something more. There's that need that I think comedians tend to have that I think is exemplified in those people too.
What, for recognition
Right.
of, I mean, yeah, I totally get that. They had all kinds of different ambitions,
And I
some of
think
them
that's the political point too,
self-deluding.
is that need to be seen is something that we can recognize in politicians too.
Well, that's that kind of brings me to the point about, obviously this is Trevor Griffiths, left-wing political playwright. He's writing a play about comedians. Now, at one level, it is about the politics of comedy. It is about what is the function of comedy, in terms of if you want to change society, because that's essentially what his basic thing was. But
Yes.
is it not, is it, I mean, was it not also actually a metaphor for politics? I mean,
Yeah, I think so.
so the agent's kind of like right-wing Labour or conservative. Give the audience what they want. Don't give them monkeys about anything else. Give them a laugh. That's all they want. Don't teach them, and then you'll get the reward. You'll get it. And then there's Geffen, who basically he's kind of like a revolutionary, isn't he? And he's kind of talking to Eddie, the teacher, and it's their dialogue. I mean, it's like reformist, the reformist left, that's Eddie, and the revolutionary left, that's Geffen, and it's their dialogue about what role comedy can play within all that. If you want to change society, what do you do? And I mean, Geffen was all about hate, and it was just undiluted, wasn't it? And then he wants to, Eddie wants to kind of soften it a bit,
But
which
Eddie's
Geffen
soft
at the end
left,
says, well, you've lost touch with your roots. Life is still hard for people like us, and you've lost touch with that.
What did you both think of the Irish comedian in it?
Well, there were two, weren't there? There was the one that was the successful one, the one from Northern Ireland, and then there was the Southern Irish one, wasn't there? Which one?
The Northern Irish one. What did you think of him? Because I thought, well, that was a very interesting part,
I think he's
and a
the
very
most
interesting
interesting
portrayal.
part of all. Because you could see the tussle within him, and
Yeah.
his sort of, he was naturally quite funny,
Yes.
and he panicked and he just went straight into the Irish jokes when on stage, went
And the
into
wife and
audience.
stuff about his wife as well, wasn't it? About being, but it was interesting. But you're absolutely right. That was a very much more subtle kind of interesting role, because although he's one of the two, are the only two that gets the interest of the agent, isn't it? But then the other one, the Jewish comedian who just was, I mean, he was, I mean, I'd, I mean, I thought that was quite
Like
stereotypically
full
Jewish.
Bernard Manning, didn't he?
Yeah, because he was a club, he ran a club, and it was just not a great club like Bernard Manning did. But when he was trying to pal up with the Irish comedian and say, "Oh, give you a lift," and then he oh you and said, "No, I can't. I've got to go back to my wife." So, "Oh, your wife won't begrudge you that." And then he turns on him quite severely. My wife does not begrudge me anything. Like, it's sort of, you don't know what to do with him, even though they're both relatively successful. So I don't know what do you make of that? Because that he was kind of mainstream, but and yet he wasn't, he was still a decent person, he seemed.
He felt like
I
almost
think,
the mainstream, but the one you like.
Oh, okay.
Well, and also we've got the, of course, a play is only 90 minutes long and it finishes. And the lovely thing about plays back in the 70s and 80s was there was no closure. There was no, let's leave the door open for a sequel, or no Hollywood happy endings. So you get what you get. But also, maybe not in 75, but by the time it gets broadcast on some, but in 79, as play today, we know what's coming. We know what's coming. We know what, everything sort of is written in its time. When you see a World War II film done in the 1960s, and you're thinking, why have they all got beehives, or why have they all got sideburns, or something like that? Everything's embedded in its time, but it's moving on. That by the time it's 79, this was already happening. Alexis Sale was starting to work. They'd set up, two venues, three venues in London where people were desperately trying out stuff, thinking, what, how does this work? So, the people who did the ventriloquist act, that was much more akin to the sort of stuff that started. Everyone was doing really weird cod music hall acts, not everyone, most people were, with a slight transgressive, or I mean, most of it just involved spliffs, but there'd be something, an Age of Empire with a little alternative twist on it. Do you know what I mean? Intriguing, the Irish guy, the Northern Irish guy. But that's what I was going to say. Given the time it was in, what's going to happen down the pike? What is he going to be, another Billy Connolly? Is he going to, somebody who starts off, doing this, and then, or Lenny Henry, he starts off doing this and
I
then he morphs
wouldn't
into
have,
this.
I di I wouldn't have thought that for him. No, because I mean, first of all, that agent wouldn't have been interested in that. The agent was just like, be like Max Bygraves, was it? I mean, that was hilarious when he said. Went out and said, "That's, that's your model. Be like Max Bygraves," which
But
maybe our
isn't it
listeners
funny that
won't remember who Max
Max
Bygraves was.
Bygraves is, if you think, Max Bygraves is an entertainer. He's like
I
people
now.
might hate Bob Monkhouse, but Bob Monkhouse is a comedian. Max Bygraves is an entertainer, and
Sing
there's a
along with
huge
Max.
difference. Don't frighten the horses. Finish with the song.
It's interesting you mentioned Lenny Henry, because I think in many ways he was sort of the bridge between the two worlds. Because he won New Faces, didn't he? Which was that was his break, which was very old fashioned. It was openly prime time old fashioned comedy, and then he kind of became part of the, married Dawn French, huge part of that alternative scene. In many ways, it was interesting that this man, a working class Midlands born black guy, became the bridge between those two worlds.
Yes, which then leads me to, because I was meaning to ask this, because in the play as it's put on, these are all men, these are all white men, some of whom are guilty of all kinds of racist jokes. Although in future productions, there was an all woman, version of the play, which is interesting. But in the play as set. There's somebody that comes into the class who has been clearly given the wrong kind of instructions, and it's an Asian guy, and he's looking for an English re reading for English class, and somebody's just taken the mickey out of him, saying that there was a going to be a class there. So he goes into the room, and the teacher sort of takes pity on him because he's a bit confused, and he's kind of there, but he's not really there. I mean, he's not there for the class, he's just a bit confused. So he kind of hangs around, and he seemingly goes to see them do all their acts, and then he comes back with them for the final kind of assessment of all of that. But it ends, right? So it ends with him telling a joke. I mean, he's not there to tell a joke, is he? But he tells He tells a joke, which is, as this is from my country, and about a cow and a Man's he kills a cow pretending that he thinks it's a horse, and maybe the teacher says that's a Jewish joke. That's a Jew. That's a Jew. And then he asks him, and at the very, very end, he said, "Well, you might be interested in coming to one of my future classes." Dot dot dot. That's the end, isn't it? Apart from the caretaker coming in
But
explaining.
it's a very optimistic end, I think. I mean, I
Yes.
know, but I think it's very optimistic that Gethin goes, I don't want this. I think that's good. But it's very optimistic. I mean, I run workshops all over the world, and people tell me, I did one in Shanghai, and I did several in Shanghai actually. And people tell me that, this humor is very, very local, and it isn't. It isn't. It's very universal, traditionally, I know, like they say in the play, certain acts couldn't perform north of or south of Watford Junction. That I get that, and I grew up thinking that. Jimmy Jewell, who played the original part of the teacher, he never really cracked it on the Southern Circuit at that particular time. But yeah,
Human.
it's the universality. So I had these women. I remember one day, one of the workshops, the class was almost exclusively the new rich from Shanghai. And I remember these massively tall, elegant, better fed, much higher tax bracket if they're in the West, women in pearls. And, I just felt like this grubby little Celt, sort of, oh, welcome to our comedy class. And we did a few really simple medieval master servant things. And of course, they got it. They got it. They got the idea of like status drop and that, and it was just a joy to watch. So I think there's a universality in humor. As I say in my book, I think it's something that we've been doing as long as we've had speech. I think this is, and maybe even before that, if you believe some anecdotal stories from zoologists. But this is something we're good at, and it's an evolu serves an evolutionary purpose, right? And individually, you might want fame and the glittering prizes, and it's always comedy, not therapy. But on some level, the act of comedy is therapeutic or artistic or changing you as an individual and hopefully you as a society. Nick Revel used to have the brilliant joke about 20 years of old terms of comedy changing the world, and here we are with Margaret Thatcher still in power.
Didn't Peter
Hook.
Cook, thank you, God.
No, I'm the same way.
Well, what's so amazing is how much those Weimar comedy clubs changed everything in the
That's what he
1930s.
said. And political
So
satire in the
just
1960s. Yeah. That's Enoch Powell, didn't it? Yeah.
Well, but it did. But again, it's easy to go. It's the defense of the middle class. God save the world from liberals, where we'll go, oh yeah, but really we should still all do this, shouldn't we? It did change things. It did
Yeah,
change
absolutely.
things. It maybe not changed them enough, but it gave the thing about alternative comedy, we weren't working collectively. It just gave a little push, right? It gave a little push. And if it's led to Frankie Boyle, that's good. If it's
Jimmy
led
Carr.
to Josie Long, if anybody's seen her, that's a good thing. It's like there's a if it's changed the landscape a little tiny bit, that's good.
I was wondering to sort of draw it to a conclusion, like this, so the play was written in, 70, put on its first 75. It's very 1970s. It's been revived quite a few times, as I've said, in one version with all women. But is this something that should be left in its own time? That what if it's ever going to be put on again, or can it be adapted, or is it just too much of its own time to sort of be so, or we'll tweet, we'll take out a reference to Max Margraves, we'll talk about, Michael McIntyre instead, and Lou Macari doesn't play for United anymore. Let's talk about, well, everyone's rubbish who plays for United. Not Garnacho, right? You can chant Garnacho's name. Or is it, can it be tweaked, or is it just so different to how comedy is and the politics of things are now that it should be a very good period piece to just leave it there?
But I hope they don't tweak it because you start getting to territory like, when the Restoration wrote King Lear to have a happy ending.
Oh,
You know,
yeah.
you want, you know, you don't, you know, it's if it's got a point to make. I mean, we haven't had a chance to talk about it, but the idea of one of the under when you're watching it as a play for today, you think, and he makes reference to Auschwitz, and you start thinking about the idea of comedy as power, or power using comedy. That's a better way of putting it. Power, and oppression using comedy as a way to, it's never really said, but in the use of the jokes that they all fall back on with the in the show, as a way of putting people in their place, controlling, putting back in the box, so changing nothing. But yeah, so I hope they keep it the way it is. I think it'll always get done because there'll always be a bunch of students going to the Edinburgh Festival who think, well, we did Bacchae last year. What can we do that's vaguely revolutionary now? You know, Edward Bond's too slow. Let's do this, you know.
I mean, I don't know about you, Emma. What do you think about that? I mean, I was just thinking that if, I mean, some of the jokes that are told in Comedians, whether some people would object to those jokes being told, the anti-Irish, the Pakistani joke, the women's jokes, anti-women jokes.
I was expecting all of that. I mean, I knew it came out the year I was born. I remember vaguely the sort of birth of, well, I don't remember the actual birth of alternative comedy. I remember it starting to be on telly, watching the Young Ones as a very young girl and absolutely adoring the anarchy of it all and Friday Night Live, Saturday Night Live coming on and finding all these amazing new comedians. I actually had the privilege of, when I was in Australia in 2020, going to a comedy workshop gig by Tim Ferguson, who was part of the Doug Anthony All Stars, one of the who I had on the telly in the late 80s and completely fallen in love with as an act, a wonderful, wonderful comedy trio. And being able to then see them then live a few, a few years ago after a 20-year break, and then getting to meet Tim Ferguson, who's just an absolute hero of mine in terms of comedy. And just thinking about the progression of that whole movement from the alternative to the mainstream, and what that had done in terms of both comedy and the discussion of comedy, and what we think of a comedy and how we talk about things like kicking down and kicking up, which never would have been part of the discussion when this play was made. And I'm watching this play and thinking how, just in terms of the discussion of comedy, there is still such a relevance of it in the role it plays in society, even though society has changed and comedy has changed. Watching that discussion take place still has, I think, resonance and relevance.
And
Well,
I mean, I know the trouble is, just turn me off is the short answer. But the thing is, like, we all want to be artists, but all of us didn't have enough love as a child at the same time. So part of us wants to be a crowd pleaser. So that, I think there will always be a relevance, because there's always some point where you're saying, you see being Picasso doing blue lips, and you just think, oh, I'll do what my audience, it's like, oh, they're a bit old. Look at this audience, they're a bit old. They won't get my drug-related material, so I'll just talk about this or that. It's like, that's what I love about Robin Ince. He doesn't pander, as a comedian, he doesn't pander. He will talk about obscure bands, because the material isn't about obscure bands. The material is about the attitude behind it and the one-upmanship, So, but as soon as you start going, oh, I don't know if my audience would like that, is a sign of death, I think. So yeah, hope it keeps on getting done.
Right.
I
Well,
just think with any comedy, if it makes you laugh, like if you can make yourself laugh, if you think, oh, that's funny, I like that. Like I came up with a quite odd joke during our time together, Logan, but it was filthy. It was absolutely filthy. And it combined politics and masturbation. And you know what? It made me laugh. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm
yeah.
sure I'll make one other person out there laugh. And if I think it's funny, then I'm going to just do it.
Yeah.
But the question was, could I do it bravely enough? Because if I'd swallowed that joke, if I'd been scared of that joke,
Yeah, 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 yeah.
then it
Yeah.
never would have worked. But it worked because I was ballsy enough to just go out and deliver it.
Yeah.
Well, on that bombshell,
Yeah.
we should probably end. And then
Yeah.
after this ends, I want you to tell the joke, Emma, because I'm
Well, okay.
interested to know what that is. But on that bombshell, we will end. And this has been a Political Human production. We have to thank No, we don't have to. We do it all the
No.
time. We do. We want to thank. No, not you yet. We have to
All right, then. I
Lord
will be
Stuart
thanked.
Wood for our theme tune. But we do thank both because we have to and because we want to. Logan Murray for being our guest and to giving us this really interesting insight into how the play relates to comedy today and those kind of issues. And it behoves me to finally bring this to an end by pleading with you to rate and review this podcast. I don't know if anybody ever does, on whatever platform you may be listening to us on.